So I want to begin this evening with a teaching I received many years ago from one of my teachers. Of course, we all have many teachers. This is from my teacher, Reverend Ray Demers. And this happened about 9 years ago. And it was in the fall, and we had been, we moved into the temple in late August, and we were preparing for a retreat in October. We thought that would be plenty of time to build 30 bunk beds and do everything we needed to do. It turned out to be a little bit more complicated than we thought. Ray, from the very beginning, was one of the people who thought this was a good idea. So I sort of blame him in many ways for this mess we're in. But Ray and I were sitting out in the garage. I think we were staining bunk beds or doing something. And I was sitting there just in wonder that we were here preparing for a retreat at this place that 6 months ago none of us had even imagined. And I said, turned to Ray and I said, what are the odds that we'd be here? And Ray said, 100%. 100%. And for me, I so remember that, that 100%. Same thing, this ragtag group of sitters here this evening from all corners of the world, from all the different moments of our life. What are the odds that we would be here together? Ta-da! 100%. This moment, unconditionally accepting what each moment has to offer, as Laura so wonderfully reminded us. Here we are. Actually, there's no choice left. We can decide, maybe we can decide tomorrow, but right now, for this moment, there is no other place we can be. No other time, just this. So many moments, of course, if we had a choice, we would say no thank you. I'd rather have the other choice on the menu, but we don't get to pick our course of study here in the world of being a human being. We are born into particular families, and all of us fiercely working on our family koans, the ones that our parents were given by their parents and their parents, and all of us try to make the best of, and can only make the best of what we have been given. One teacher, Joanna Macy, another teacher of mine, a Buddhist teacher who's been very socially active for decades now. I once did an exercise with her of imagining choosing our birth, imagining choosing from all the stars in the universe which star you would like to be to move toward, and then imagining which planet of the star, and picking this blue-green planet, and then imagining that you could pick any time of the world to be born, but trying to pick a time where you could accomplish your mission, where you could make some difference, and that you chose the exact date of your birth. And then you chose a life form to be born as, could be born as anything, but chose to be a human. And then chose the country of your birth. Which country will you be born in, where you can accomplish whatever it is your task is? And then even picking your parents. And again, a thought exercise, but imagine choosing your particular parents with all of their gifts and all of their flaws, because only they can teach you what you need to know. Only they can give you the support and the challenges and the difficulty necessary to become yourself. And quite a thing to choose, even to imagine choosing. But in some ways, in our Zen practice, we are choosing to be ourself. Saying yes to what arises moment after moment. And our reading tonight from Secrets on Cultivating the Mind is by one of our great ancestors, one of our great Korean ancestors, who lived in the 12th century. And Chunul is actually the founder, considered the founder of the Chogye order of Korean Rinzai Zen. The Kwanum school, which I trace my lineage through the Kwanum school, is part of this Chogye order. So my teacher, George Bowman, was a Dharma heir, one of the first three Dharma heirs of Sun Sanim, who was a Korean teacher who came over to this country, to Providence, Rhode Island, in the early 70s. So sitting in this room, we are here, we are Dharma heirs, all of us, of Chunul, this human being who lived so long ago, and who had some burning desire to know for himself. He was quite a practitioner, and he lived in a time when Zen Buddhism, called Son in Korean, when the Son school and Buddhism in general was quite powerful. Huge monasteries owned vast tracts of land and wielded great power in the court. Chunul grew up in this time and was recognized and passed his exams and was seen as a leading light, and decided that he didn't want to do that. That all of the power and all of the intrigue was not really what this was about. And so he left the cities and went up into the mountains so he could practice, and gathered together with a few friends to do this work, and wrote many texts that have been studied for centuries now, including this one, Secrets on Cultivating the Mind. And in the passage we read, he's talking about sudden awakening and gradual awakening, or gradual cultivation. And this sudden versus gradual has actually been a wondrously long controversy in the Zen school, going back to the 8th and 9th century earliest days. And it's been a kind of an argument about whether awakening happens by gradually wearing down and wearing out the things that get in the way and then spontaneously appears, or whether it comes in one great bright flash. And the past few days we've been talking about enlightenment and the dangers of the ideas we make of it, but these different schools, and have said before, but I think it bears repeating, that these two sides of the coin. At the end, Chanul says, sudden and gradual cultivation are like two wheels of a cart. Neither one can be missing. And in his place in the country, his little temple in the woods, the deep woods, Chanul called his group the Prajna and Samadhi group. Prajna being the alert, dynamic quality, penetrating quality, and Samadhi being the calm abiding. And Chanul was very clear, as almost every Zen teacher, whatever their background, is that these are both qualities that need to be cultivated. This way-seeking mind, this penetrating, this prajna, sometimes we talk about Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, almost always depicted with a sword, the sword that cuts through delusion. And so as we practice, we need to wield this sword. And then samadhi, this calm abiding, similar in some ways to the qualities of Kanzeon, the bodhisattva of compassion, often put on the altar with Manjushri. So these two qualities of our practice, and of course our practice is a dynamic thing. That we've talked about how there's no rule book for accomplishing your death and no rule book for Zen. No one can tell you how to do this. Indeed, no one knows how to do this. But when we head in this direction, we somehow find our way. John Tarrant, another one of our more recent ancestors on the Soto side, has come several times to the temple, and once he came and was talking about koans, and he said, you should not work on your koan, but rather allow your koan to work on you. And so it is with our practice. We cannot do our practice, but our practice does us, and we go along as best we can. With this constant leaning into the moment, or being constantly trying to discern what is this, what is called for here. The Buddha used the image of a string on a musical instrument, too tight and the string snaps, and too loose and there's no music. So where is this middle way? Not too tight and not too loose, and it is not a fixed position. It's like if you're steering a car, if you hold the steering wheel exactly still, you will go off the road. The only way to stay on the road is constantly a little bit here and a little bit there. And even in steering a car, we don't know how we do it. You can try to explain it to someone, but you cannot explain it. They have to learn for themselves. And so all of us here steering the car of ourself down the road, down this path, sometimes dark, sometimes light, sometimes icy, sometimes traffic jam, and we just lay on our horn and give the bird to the person next to us. Here we are. Traditionally, the understanding, and certainly it was mine when I began, is that we practice so that we can become enlightened. And so you practice and you practice and you practice, and at some point you get something. You get the big Buddha sticker to put on your forehead. In some ways, some truth to that, but maybe not so much. Dogen was so wonderfully clear when he talked about practice is enlightenment, and enlightenment is practice. How do we get somewhere that we already are? If we're already awakened, then how do we manifest that? And so we manifest our enlightened nature by sitting upright and still, and the means is exactly the goal. There is not a difference. And Chanul, in thinking about this, said that actually awakening comes before practice. I really appreciate this, because you would not be here unless you had sensed something or had some experience or some intimation this possibility of life, some intimation that the body is not just the four elements and that things are not as they appear. And that it's from these intimations that we even come to practice. And that as we practice, then we get more of these intimations. And awakening is so often, I think, misleading, as we've been saying, that these little moments... Chanul says, speaking about people, that they look for Buddha outside their mind, and while they are thus wandering aimlessly, the entrance to the road might by chance be pointed out by a wise advisor. So part of this sudden awakening, part of this glimpse, is we realize just have this fleeting sense, perhaps, of the vastness that we are a part of, this great boundless life that is none other than this breath coming in and going out. We get that glimpse, and there are some glimpses and some experiences that stop us in our tracks. We do indeed see the face of God. There is no doubt in my mind that each one of us tastes this, touches this, knows this in some way. And that if you practice, you will have experiences like this. James Ford, I think, was quoting someone when he said that awakening is an accident, but practice makes us accident prone. But Chanul goes on to say that we get these awakenings, and even in some big awakening where you see deeply into this nature of boundlessness, that still the habit force is strong. He says, although people have awakened to the fact that their original nature is no different from that of all Buddhas, the beginningless habit energies are extremely difficult to remove suddenly, and so they, meaning we, must continue cultivation while relying on this awakening. So as we sit, we are cultivating our capacity to meet the moment. And whether we have had just a tiny taste of this realm of non-duality, or whether we have had some earth-shaking experience, doesn't matter. That it's not like once you have some experience, then you get to be someone different. And this gradual cultivation while relying on the awakening. So this is relying on some sense that you have, some memory in your body, because every time we touch what is true and sacred and beautiful, we are changed. We cannot hold on to it, and if we try to hold on to it, we suffer. But we are changed, and it is a part of us, and we carry these experiences with us, even when we forget them. So we rely on something that is already apparent to us. While we do this endless practice, one 20th century Japanese teacher, Katagiri Roshi, said, let us practice for 100,000 kalpas with great joy. So no need to rush. It's a little bit like working on koans here in Boundless Way. The only thing you get when you move through one koan is the next koan. And there are books and books and hundreds of koans, so no need to rush, nowhere to go. And so it is with this practice of Zen. If you practice for 20 more years, you will end up right where you are. And here you are already at the end, already in the Lotus Land. So just encouragement to us all to appreciate the moments of insight, appreciate the cutting through, and then appreciate this endless practice. This practice is our love song to the universe. This practice is our calling out to the universe. This practice is our endless dance, endless dance of intimacy. So take heart. There is nowhere to go. No ending, no beginning, endless awakening and endless practice. Thank you. So please sit comfortably. And we'll have time for a few questions or reactions. Yeah. Nat.
What you said and what Sheena said that struck me most was this notion of relying on one's awakening while one goes through all the thoughts and all the habits. And today I actually had some suicidal thoughts. I mean, it's all the Buddha having these thoughts. And that's what saves me time and again, is this reliance, this confidence. And I think it's what has to be nurtured the most, the confidence that you're Buddha going through the world. Yeah. And having these experiences. And sometimes it's really tough to come up with that confidence, come up with it.
Yeah, yeah.
But without it, I don't know where I'd be.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that, connecting the confidence to the relying. So it's trusting something. It is that confidence. Sun Sanim, my teacher's teacher, was big about confidence. You know, only go straight, only trust. Don't check. So important. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
This morning's talk by one of our senior Dharma teachers had a part in it where he said something about, gee, if we were going to be advertising this religion, it'd be like, oh yeah, come on and sit around for a while and sit still and do nothing and be in a lot of pain. Yes, yeah, sign me up. Something like that. And it made me think of an advertising slogan we could use that said, nothing guaranteed. And then in your talk, there's a wonderful reminder that why are we doing this? There's no reason. There's no reason behind it. It's not something you can think out and put into columns and say, yeah, this makes sense and this makes sense, and it balances out all the ways it doesn't make sense. You just do it. And I so appreciate that and so totally can't explain it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, it is the, I think, several people have spoken about this, but this mystery that we don't know what we're doing or how we're doing it or even who's doing it. And the more we enter in, and reasons, I think Melissa was saying, reasons are important. We start with, you know, one thing, and that's important, and then as we continue, it falls away or changes or morphs, and yeah, we're just, we're in it. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, on the way, all these years, different paths that my life has been on spiritually, and you kind of, I get these senses of like, oh, if everybody fill in the blank, then things would be fine. Or, and I don't mean like there's no trouble or no gravity or no fleshy vulnerability. I don't mean that, but like all these like ways to acknowledge reality compassionately. And I think along the way I thought, well, if it is true, if everybody did this, it would be fine. And lately, a friend of mine has been really struggling with faith and articulating it all the time, and so it's like gotten in my craw, and I've had a million thoughts about it, but one thing that just keeps coming to me is like this confidence, this reliability that we can't see. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, I know it's hypothetical or whatever, I'm not trying to conjecture too much, but this, like, if not now, when? This sense of that, the stepping off into something, so much seems like the thing of if only everyone, well, I am everyone. Like, and it doesn't really matter if anyone else isn't. Mm-hmm. It is the way. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so, but it's so hard because of all these influences and all the things of the beliefs I don't even know I have, you know. But anyway, I just was thinking.
Yeah, that, I'm very struck by part of what you said. I think that a lot of us carry a delusion that if only everyone, you know, say practiced Zen, then everything would be fine. And actually, I don't think everything would be fine. You know, the nature of life is to suffer. Right? That's one of the first things that the Buddha declared after his awakening. That suffering is a part of life, so there's no escape from it, except to go into it, right? To really dive right in and go, what is this? I think that's very important, that there's no, you know, lotus land over there that we're gonna discover if only we, you know, practice or whatever. I mean, that, it's related to what Janine said, you know, there's not really a reason for doing this. That's rational. And yet, we're pulled to practice anyway. And I think it goes back to the confidence that Nat and David were talking about. And that we were talking about earlier today. You know, as one of the three essentials. This confidence, this great faith, that there's no, this utter reliability, you know, that all these teachers are pointing to. So it's quite a mystery. As you're pointing to, Joanne, and also it's just like a no-brainer on the other hand. You know, what else would we be doing? Well, lots of other things, but no, This is what we're doing. It's already accomplished. There's nothing else to do. It's right here. You know, what are the chances? 100%. This is the only place we could be.
So let's continue to be here.